The Federal Reserve steps in to stabilize credit markets.
Whether this really works depends on something that is out of the Fed's control and out of policymakers' control.
Plus, the different challenges urban and rural areas are facing responding to the pandemic.
One of the biggest concerns right now as the virus starts to spread into rural areas is about what happens when anything in the system breaks down.
It's Monday, March 23rd. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Here's what's news. We'll be getting to those stories in just a moment. But first, on Capitol Hill, Senate Democrats and Republicans continue to fight over the terms of the latest stimulus package designed to ease the damage from the coronavirus. Democrats say the $1.6 trillion bill would help businesses more than the public, while Republicans are accusing Democrats of trying to add unrelated items to the bill. The measure has failed twice in the Senate in the past 2 days. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is considering easing social distancing guidelines as early as next week. Last week, the administration urged Americans to avoid non-essential travel, dining in restaurants, and gatherings of more than 10 people for the next 2 weeks. People familiar with the discussions in the White House say advisors and business leaders are pushing the president to roll back guidance to boost the economy. But easing the guidelines would run counter to public health experts who have said sustained social distancing is necessary until the U.S. ramps up testing. And in non-coronavirus-related news, California utility PG&E has agreed to plead guilty to involuntary manslaughter for its role in the 2018 Camp Fire, which killed 85 people. The utility, which filed for bankruptcy last year, has also agreed to pay a fine of nearly $3.5 million. Our Catherine Blunt explains the plea comes amid other complications for PG&E.
Even though this plea carries a relatively small monetary fine, it comes at a juncture during which the company is trying to do a lot at once. It's trying to raise a lot of debt and equity, and it's also trying to improve its system, improve the electric grid by making billions of dollars in investments to improve the safety. So it's just another thing that the company has to contend with. But at the same time, it also lifts a cloud that's been hanging over the company for some time now.
An investigation by the Wall Street Journal found that PG&E knew for years that its power lines could spark wildfires, but failed to perform necessary upgrades on its equipment. It was another volatile session of trading for U.S. stocks today. The Dow fell nearly 1,000 points earlier in the day, recovered most of those losses, and then dropped again when the latest stimulus bill failed on Capitol Hill. The index ended the day down nearly 600 points, or about 3.1%. The drop came despite the fact that the Federal Reserve announced this morning that it would be taking more steps to shore up the economy, including extending loans to businesses and purchasing billions of dollars in government debt. Our Nick Timiraos explains.
The central bank is unveiling a new generation of lending facilities to prevent a liquidity crunch, that's the ability to buy and sell assets when firms need cash, from turning into a solvency crisis that would lead to more failures of American businesses and a lot more job losses in the days, weeks, and months ahead.
But will it work?
Let's step back here and look at what we're doing. We're essentially forcing huge swaths of the U.S. economy to shut down for some period of time in order to buy our hospitals and healthcare system enough time to deal with the spike in infections from this virus. So, whether this really works depends on something that is out of the Fed's control and out of policymakers' control. And that's really twofold. How bad is this virus, and how prepared is the healthcare system to mitigate its spread? Think of testing for the virus. If we can diagnose how widespread this is, who's getting it, who's getting cured, and so forth, it will be easier to come up with a plan of action to reopen the economy. But if we're looking at a shutdown of the economy that lasts many months, or let's say the virus comes back later this year, then all of these actions probably won't be enough.
Broadway is closed. Times Square is empty. New York, the city that never sleeps, went on pause Sunday night to reduce the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. New York isn't the only city on lockdown. and a lot of city folks are wondering if it wouldn't be better to get in the car and head out to the country. National parks are full of escapists. But rural areas are facing challenges of their own dealing with the crisis. To compare, we reached out to our New York reporter Ben Chapman and national correspondent Ian Lovett, who's been covering the response in rural communities throughout the country. Ben, let's start here in New York, which has now become the epicenter of the virus in the U.S. Some new restrictions actually went into place just last night. What can you tell us about what it looks like in New York right now?
New York is experiencing a rapid increase in the number of diagnosed cases, with nearly 21,000 individuals testing positive for the virus as of Monday. That's about 60% of confirmed cases nationwide. And a number of restrictions have recently gone into effect. Governor Cuomo issued a 10-point platform to stem the spread of the disease, specifically the things that went into effect Sunday night. A closure of all non-essential businesses. So that's basically permitting health entities, hospitals, banks, businesses involved in food, hardware stores, things like that are allowed to remain open. But things like a dry cleaner or a nail salon or a barber shop, those are all ordered closed. There's also a temporary ban canceling all non-essential gatherings of any size. So these are both steps that are intended to stop the spread of the virus in New York State.
So that's in New York. Ian, I want to turn to you. You've been reporting on rural communities where there have been coronavirus cases, like Lander, Wyoming. Tell us about what's going on there.
So Lander, Wyoming is a very small town. They have fewer than 8,000 residents, and they're in a very remote part of Wyoming, 2 hours from any interstate. So they assumed, as of, you know, even just over a week ago, that the infection might get there, but it was probably going to take a while, and maybe it wouldn't even get there at all because it's so remote. But that all changed very quickly. The town, just over a week ago, the city council passed a four-step plan for how to respond to the coronavirus, and within a couple hours, they were already on step two because they already had a positive case. And then within a few days, they had 8 positive cases, all of which were tied to a nursing home in town. Unlike New York, however, Lander has not been able to aggressively test in the same way. So, for example, there was one woman who just over a week ago was taken to the hospital. She was 63 years old. She has a degenerative lung disease, and she was complaining of a cough. But because she did not have a fever, they did not test her, and they sent her back to the nursing home. And within a few days, there was the outbreak at the nursing home, and she was one of the positive cases. Her daughter had direct contact with her, and her daughter is now quarantined with her boyfriend in her house, both of whom are having COVID symptoms, but neither of them have been tested. So unlike New York, they are very conscious of how little supplies they have, and they're being very judicious about who exactly is getting tested.
Right, and the testing has ramped up considerably in New York, something that officials do note here. That leads me to my next question for both of you. What would you say about the challenges of getting resources to rural versus urban areas? Ian, let's start with you. You just spoke about the lack of resources.
So partly there are sort of two issues. One is about getting resources in, and the other is about getting sick patients out. So in terms of getting resources in, there are private companies that are doing tests in a lot of places, but they don't go to some of the most remote areas. So the more rural places are relying more on state labs, which are very backlogged and are very slow to get results back for tests. At the same time, there's also a lot of concern in rural areas about what happens when patients get really sick. Lander, as I mentioned before, is 2 hours from the nearest interstate. They often helicopter people to nearby hospitals when they're in very severe condition, but there's not really a lot of backup when things go wrong. So one of the city council people mentioned that if someone from the helicopter crew got sick, they don't have a backup. They don't know what they would do. And that is one of the biggest concerns right now as the virus starts to spread into rural areas, is about what happens when anything in the system breaks down.
Ben, what about in New York? We've actually heard President Trump and the federal government team he's set up to combat coronavirus. He's mentioned that he spoke directly to Governor Cuomo of New York. Is there a difference in terms of getting the resources needed to an urban area versus a rural area in your experience here?
The issue in New York as far as healthcare goes in the face of the virus is one of capacity. At the moment, the state has about 53,000 hospital beds, and Governor Cuomo has said the state needs about 110,000 hospital beds in order to deal with the crisis. So basically, they need to more than double the number of beds in the state in order to prevent a disaster and to treat people who need it. And to help out with this, the Federal Emergency Management Agency is setting up 4 mobile hospitals. But basically, there's a shortfall in the number of beds. And then there are also shortages in terms of equipment, where doctors have reported wearing the same mask for as long as a week. In some of the large intensive care units have already exceeded their capacities. And there are reports of things such as emergency room physicians reusing their gowns. So there's a pretty significant shortage that is already beginning to become evident in New York.
What would you both say about the response in the communities we've been talking about? In New York, we've heard that there's still a problem of density, people not abiding by the 6-foot distancing that we're supposed to be observing. And Ian, what about in rural communities? How is the message getting out? How is that outreach going?
So the distancing has been easier in rural communities in a lot of cases. Landers in the foothills of the mountains in Wyoming. And so people are still able to go hiking and be outside and not run into a million people. The challenge in some rural areas, at least to a certain extent, has been more about getting people to take the outbreak seriously. And I think that has been why testing is important in rural areas, because a lot of people assumed that the virus was never going to make it there or was not going to make it there for quite a while. And so until they sort of saw positive tests in their own community, they were still just not taking the regulations put in place seriously. In Lander now, all the bars and restaurants are closed, the same as they are in New York, and people there are taking it seriously now. But the county commissioner in Fremont County in Wyoming, I spoke to him as well, and he lives outside Lander in an area that hasn't had any cases yet, and he called the reaction hysteria and said it was just being fueled by the media. So that's an attitude that they're dealing with in some rural places.
Ben, what would you say about the response in New York?
In New York City and other urban areas, I think that maintaining social distancing is more of a challenge. The situation in New York City has been a mixed bag. On one hand, the police have reported very few individuals who have ignored the recommendations to stay far away from each other. On the other hand, the governor visited over the weekend and flagged several large gatherings that he encountered, including a farmer's market in Brooklyn where there were throngs of people. So it's a mixed bag in the city.
All right, that's Wall Street Journal reporters Ben Chapman and Ian Lovett. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And finally, the Wall Street Journal has been calling for your questions about the coronavirus. One we've been getting a lot is whether pets can get or transmit the virus. So we put the question to Wall Street Journal science editor Daniela Hernandez.
So as with everything else with the new coronavirus, there's still a lot of unknowns, a lot of unanswered questions. The data with pets is especially limited, but it doesn't seem like this is a major form of transmission at all. So far, there's been 2 reports out of Asia that have shown that 2 separate dogs have tested positive for the virus that causes COVID-19. But health agencies throughout the world are emphasizing the fact that they don't think that this is a mode of transmission, so that the pets are not passing it to humans. However, they are still saying that out of an overabundance of caution, they still recommend that if you think you have COVID-19 or you have tested positive, to limit contact with animals.
Do you have a question about the coronavirus? Leave us a voicemail at 315-992-8298. That number is in our show description. We'll be bringing on our reporters and experts to try to answer as many of your questions as we can. And that's what's news for this Monday afternoon. If you like our show, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.